WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The success of some independent films like Pulp Fiction and The Full Monty is changing Hollywood. My guests are two of the producers in the middle of this shifting landscape. James Shamus and Ted Hope are the co-founders of Good Machine, the production company whose films include The Brothers McMullen, Safe, and Walking and Talking. Hope and Shamus describe their company as director-driven. The director they're most associated with is Ang Lee. They're currently working on his new film, and they produced his films The Wedding Banquet, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, and The Ice Storm. Here's a clip from The Wedding Banquet. The main character, a gay Chinese-American, is trying to hide his homosexuality from his parents, who still live abroad. They've sent him an application from a matchmaker, and he's trying to fill it out. Here he is with his partner.
But look at yourself. Your parents send you a form in the mail, and you practically pee your pants. You know, you are an adult. As a matter of fact, you're practically middle-aged. All right, let me check this out. Education, right?
Yes.
Well, she must have a PhD.
Nope, two PhDs.
One in physics.
And she should be an opera singer.
And 6 feet tall.
Oh, let's not go overboard. She's Chinese, after all. 5'9". And she should speak 5 languages.
Good.
You're right. It's kind of stupid, all these lies. I'm used to it.
The Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema is currently spotlighting new films produced by Ted Hope and James Shamus. I asked them to describe what a production company does. Here's James Shamus.
The work of a production company and of a producer is twofold. On the one hand, one grovels for money on behalf of film projects that one would like to make. And then once one gets the money, one mobilizes a small army of either unionized or non-unionized, fully exploitable young people to make that film. Most people think that's where the work of producing ends. But in fact, for us, that's kind of only about 1/4 of the way through. Because at that point, especially if you're independent producers, and I know that I've never really met a dependent producer before, at least one who would describe him or herself that way. But independent production is about keeping that activity outside of the purview of the studio system as long as possible. And so that what we try to do is we make the films, so to speak, below radar, and then try to inject them into the distribution and marketing systems that Hollywood and the other international distribution entities can provide.
Well, let me ask you why you'd want to make movies outside of the studio system but then distribute it within the studio system.
Well, I would say this, that the people who know how to sell movies best, which are the people in Hollywood, are often the people who know how to make movies the worst. That is to say, the skills that it takes to get somebody to buy a can full of mashed peas are not the same skills that it takes to make a meal at a 4-star restaurant. And we respect those skills enormously, skills that we don't have the resources and many times the will to hone and to exercise. On the other hand, we know that there are audiences out there that are currently underserved by the apparatus, the machine that's out there in Hollywood, and that are best served by the good machine.
Now, it seems like there's really been an explosion of independent movies, and in a way, independent films have replaced so-called art films and foreign films. Has distribution of independent films changed to keep up with this explosion?
Yeah, not only has it changed, but it's actually, I think, creating an infrastructure and a system which will probably destroy the entire independent movement which created it. That is to say, I think independent filmmakers and filmmaking are becoming victims of their own success. You know, it used to be just maybe 6 years ago, you would make a nice little $1 million movie. You would cycle a bunch of prints around, spend a little money on advertising and a publicity tour. And if you grossed $2 million, you were opening champagne bottles. You were very happy, not only emotionally, but also economically. And then came a little company called Miramax and others who started finding that if they started acting like studios in a certain way, they could get what they would call crossover hits, things like Pulp Fiction. And suddenly these companies needed to pay the rent and to pay staffs that could support releases on 2,000 screens, for example, of a film like Pulp Fiction. And you do Pulp Fiction once, you know, on a Monday, And next week, you have all the people who are there supporting Pulp Fiction. And what are they going to do next? They want another one. And suddenly, those little $1 million movies that made $2 million are economically insignificant jokes and really have nothing to do with the system itself, which has been created precisely because of the success of independent films.
The companies, the distributors, just can't take the chances they used to. They look at the minimal box office now being usually around like $5 million that they want to get from one of these specialized films, and it makes the smaller movies unreleasable. It has transformed the way film festivals work too, in that those now become kind of the old art house theaters. It's the only place that you have a chance of seeing frequently the new American independent work or the new hit foreign film. They just don't show. And it's scary and sad.
Now, Good Machine worked on Ice Storm and Sense and Sensibility, two of Ang Lee's movies, and you've been working with Ang Lee basically throughout his career. So I'm wondering if you feel that you too have fallen victim in a way to this, you know, larger ambition type of movie, the bigger budget, the bigger distribution.
Well, we still very much balance the large films with the small films. And being a director-driven company, we're forced to grow when the directors grow. Ang's vision, you know, has changed quite a bit from the days of Wedding Banquet to now with Ride with the Devil. But the films that are showing currently at the Philadelphia Film Festival, for instance, are all first-time directors, movies that were made with budgets of under $1 million. And we have several of those still in development, you know, that we hope to find many more Ang Lees that will grow with.
Yes, but there's no reason to be defensive, Ted. I mean, it's really fun making big Hollywood movies. In fact, the system is changing quite dramatically as Hollywood itself understands the need to be able to identify different kinds of audiences and audiences that are more interested in more provocative fare. So the system itself is starting to eat its young, so to speak, and to bring them into the fold, and we're obviously following along. You know, it's not that we don't want to sell out. We would desperately love to sell out. Nobody has just offered to buy us.
James, you mentioned the problem of independent cinema becoming a victim of its own success, and you mentioned Pulp Fiction in that category. What about The Full Monty? Is that considered an independent film? It's certainly been very commercially successful, more so than anybody expected.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, I mean, these discussions which rage within the film community as to what is truly an independent movie. And these days, that discussion itself, I think, is a kind of a lure to get people involved in some kind of identification with independence. But I happen to find the topic wildly itself, just as on its own, wildly misleading, given the fact that The Full Monty was financed by a young independent filmmaker named Rupert Murdoch, and its wild success worldwide goes directly into his pockets. In other words, yeah, it's an independent film. These are young, emerging filmmakers trying to do something fun and new. They're coming from a corner of the world and a place in that world which is not particularly known for its cinematic dominance, that is to say Sheffield, England. And they've made a wonderful film that has played around the world. It has played around the world via a support system provided by Fox Films International. And a subsidiary here in the United States called Fox Searchlight, with whom we actually have made a number of films too. And the people who run those companies love movies and love to make new and interesting kinds of movies that people love to see. And at the end of the day, Rupert Murdoch figures out what their bonus is at Christmas time based on the performance of those movies, just as he figures out everybody else's bonus in that empire.
Tell me a little bit about how distributing a film is different when the film is a very inexpensive film compared to when there's a lot more money behind it.
Well, usually for that type of movie, the main way that they market is through the critics' reviews, that they depend on what the New York Times, the L.A. Times, the major papers say, and that will determine how much money is then spent on it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they used to claim that it had something to do with something they called word of mouth. The problem is that you now book a film into a theater for its opening night on Friday night, and by Saturday morning, the theater owners pretty much know whether or not they're going to want to throw that movie out the next week for the next big indie hit to come along. They're not going to give it much of a chance, much time to grow through the old-fashioned way of people talking to each other about what they thought about the film. They're going to look at the opening day grosses, just as they do with Hollywood films, to determine how the marketing has worked and how it's drawn people into the theater. And they're going to believe that that's how independent films should be bought and sold in the marketplace. So word of mouth these days, unless people are talking on their cell phones during the movie, is not going to help an independent film that much.
Back when October Films got started, I think their second release was Mike Leigh's Life is Sweet, which, if I recall correctly, it's in its eighth week did more business than in its previous weeks. Those days are long gone, and it's sad and unfortunate, because how do you make a film such as A Life is Sweet or a more personal vision reach a wide audience and have that audience respond? You depend on word of mouth, and that, as James has so articulately put it, doesn't exist anymore.
See, Ted, you were agreeing with me.
Now, there's something called platforming, which is a strategy where you release a new film to a small number of theaters in select cities, and then you slowly open the film in more cities. What's the strategy behind that? Is that to get more word of mouth in the new cities?
Yeah, platforming, which is still in use, although in a rather accelerated, hyped-up, speeded-up way these days than it used to be, was a very low-cost way to distribute films city by city, market by market, where you would build a consensus among media opinion makers in major markets like New York and Los Angeles, and then you would bring the film, you'd take the print from one city and just move it over to another city, and you would put out an ad there and you would release it in that city. And you would avoid having to buy things like advertising on network television or national cable television or national radio. And you would avoid having to buy advertising spreads in national print media. So you could try to do a very low-cost, labor-intensive, city-by-city approach to the release. So you have a film, for example, a decade ago, Howard's End, that was released by the management team that now runs Sony Pictures Classics. And they had that film in release for well over a year. And it would just go, at any given time, it would be on maybe 20, 30, 40 screens around the country. But those screens would change slowly. Nowadays, you could never get a foothold into one of those smaller markets unless you can prove to the theater owners that you're supporting the release of that film in that market within a very aggressive marketing campaign. So the bar has been raised, and the price of admission to the marketplace is now so high that you begin, even for films like Howard's End, you begin to have to act like the studios. That is to say, buy your opening weekend by cramming the advertising down the throats of your target audience and hoping they'll respond to that advertising.
Do you ever feel like your budgets end up being out of whack because of the necessities of the marketplace, where you know, you've kept the budget really low for the filmmaking and it really came in very inexpensively, and then you have to blow a lot of money just getting it into the theaters?
Well, let me give you one example. We recently made a movie for a very small budget, and when the film was being released, a music video tying in one of the songs that was used in the soundtrack was produced for approximately one-fourth the budget of the entire movie.
Right.
So I mean, four music videos would have added up to more than the cost of the entire film.
What was the film?
Am I allowed to say, Ted?
Yeah, you can say.
It was called, what was it called?
She's the One.
Oh, She's the One. Eddie Burns' film, starring Jennifer Aniston.
My guests are James Shamus and Ted Hope, founders of the production company Good Machine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ted Hope and James Shamus, founders of the independent movie production company Good Machine. I think Harvey Keitel's success in several independent films like Bad Lieutenant and Reservoir Dogs, The Piano, certainly Pulp Fiction, has made a lot of actors realize that it's sometimes really worth the risk to be in a movie by an unknown or not well-known director, because sometimes those films make it big. Have you found that there are a lot of bigger stars who maybe aren't getting as many big roles at the moment who are anxious to be in the hot new independent film, although they don't necessarily know which film will be the hot film? Is that door more open now than it used to be?
The entire business of trading in stardom and stars has changed totally. Vis-a-vis the independent world in the past 3 years. And I do credit Pulp Fiction in particular and Bruce Willis's role in Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah.
With that, because you had a situation before Pulp Fiction, more or less, in which you would independent producers like us would call the studios, and usually they'd have caller ID and be able to just block the call. Or call the agencies. But we would call up an agent. We'd say, we'd really love to have, you know, a big star in our movie. We think he'd be great. And just, you know, I'm sure they'd love, even stars like to act occasionally. And wouldn't this be wonderful? And the agents would always say the same thing, which is, I'd love to do this because I love your filmmaker and I love you guys. And my actors, I'm sure, would love you too. But if anybody finds out that they're not taking $15 or $20 million to be in a movie, they'll never get their quote, which is their price, from the studios ever again. So if I ever let my actor take less for another job than his highest paid previous gig, I will ruin his position in the marketplace. And this was a constant refrain to us for about 5 years. And then slowly certain careers, and also the career of Keanu Reeves, I know it's hard to remember, it's so long ago, but Keanu actually began his career by being in very low-budget independent films with directors like Gus Van Sant, and then going into big-budget Hollywood comedies like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And he would go back and forth. And no one had really been managed that way before. And people started to take notice. And by the time Bruce Willis showed up in Pulp Fiction for a mere $150,000, which sounds like a lot of money to me, but apparently it was chump change for him at the time, and survived that, in fact, thrived on that choice, suddenly producers like Ted and myself, who used to be just complete, you know, persona non grata at the agencies, are really doing a lot of business there. And it's great for the agents because even agents like movies, it turns out. And they really do like to get their clients into interesting stuff. So it's been a wonderful change. The problem, of course, is nowadays, as one or two independent films actually make a lot of money each year, suddenly Bruce Willis is on offer to our latest low-budget independent film. But at the same time, they say, but come on, let's get $15 million. Let's get $20 million for him. I mean, you know, you'll make it back.
That changing tide is also, I think, harmed some of the unique qualities of independent specialized film. There's often a tendency of what I call casting for failure, where these former stars are now, you know, eager to be in your independent film, but they're not fresh. What people like to see in a specialized film is a discovery, is you know, something that they haven't experienced before. And frequently you see these, you know, video names or stars of yesteryear populating all of these, you know, cool new indie films, and it ends up being a kind of tired formula.
Wait, I think what you're saying is you don't want your independent films to be used like the Love Boat. It's a sanctuary for washed-up stars.
it happens quite a bit now.
But you
sometimes that's really exciting, you know, that, you know, certainly who, you know, Tarantino's a genius for it, you know.
But Tarantino takes actors who he really loves, who are sometimes pretty obscure, like Robert Forster or Lawrence Tierney, and and revives their career through this real passion for them, not because he just got a goodbye or something.
Certainly.
James, you've said that you think that it's best now to make movies outside of the Hollywood system, to make them independently where you have more creative control, but then to distribute the films within the Hollywood system because that's the system that really knows how to sell movies. I believe that you have a distribution deal now with 20th Century Fox. Is that right?
Yeah, we have what's known as a first look deal with all the different divisions at Fox, which obligates us to show them material that we're interested in making before we show it to anybody else. And for that right, they pay an overhead contribution to us. And let me go ahead and completely contradict what I said earlier. We found that working within the Hollywood system with the right people can be just as much fun and just as creative as working outside it with either the right or the wrong people. In other words, it's really it's not so much the amount of money on the check that makes the difference. It's who's signing the check. And if you find the right people, you're in pretty good shape. If everyone knows what the movie is that you want to make and we're all in agreement when we go forward that that's the movie we want to make.
I would say unequivocally that the films that we've made in the studio system have been enhanced by making it in that fashion.
Well, look at Aang's films in particular. I have to say that if you take a look at The Wedding Banquet, which we made completely independently, we in writing and producing that film and marketing it, we understood more than implicitly that we were really remaking a classic Hollywood film. This was a screwball comedy, 40s style type of film, except that it happened to be Chinese and gay. But in its essence, it's really classic Hollywood cinema. As Aang's career has progressed or evolved or just simply chronologically unfolded, and we have come closer and closer to the belly of the beast of the studio system, to where now we really make movies very much within that system, his movies, oddly enough, have become weirdly more avant-garde. And I think The Ice Storm, for example, this is a studio film with major stars in it, and yet the last 10 minutes of screen time of that film are almost completely silent. There's literally one sentence spoken in the last 10 minutes of that movie. That's a studio film?
My guests are James Shamus and Ted Hope, founders of the production company Good Machine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ted Hope and James Shamus, founder of the independent movie production company Good Machine. You're both on the set now in Kansas City shooting, working with Ang Lee on his new movie, which is being shot now. And this is a Civil War movie, yes?
It's a film that takes place during the Civil War, but on its western frontier, so that unlike other Civil War movies where you have lots of reenactors charging across fields and boringly pretending they're killed when something blows up next to them, this is a film that really goes to the heart, we think, of a kind of suppressed history of the American Civil War, which was where it was really neighbor against neighbor.
It's the border war between Missouri and Kansas.
And the movie's called Ride with the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
So is part of your job on the set here to keep the costs contained? I mean, do you have to say something like, this scene is being shot too many times, it's going over budget, and you've got to just finish it on the next take? Do you have to be the bad guys?
You certainly sometimes have to pull the plug. The nature of producing is the balance, though, between the financial aspects and the creative aspects. We do, you know, run what's known as hot costs every day. We know what each day has cost us and how it's varied from our initial predictions. And that does influence what you have to shoot, because at a certain point, maybe you've spent too much. But the role of the producer is to try to keep that all in line. So far, I think Aang has got everything that he's wanted.
Well, Aang is always surprised, because when I write screenplays for him, as I did on Ice Storm and on this film, I'll be on set and I'll say, look, you guys have got to cut out the rest of the scene. We don't really need it. Or, you know, just cover it in the master shot. Let's move on to the next thing. And Aang turns to me and goes, but you wrote it. Don't you want to see it on the screen? I said, when I was writing it, I was a writer, but now I'm a producer. Get moving, pal. So, you know, he's always a little shocked at how brutal I'll be in terms of delivering the movie on budget and within the framework of that the production has provided.
So, how do you, as a producer, justify telling him to cut a scene that you wrote and that you like?
Well, you know, what you try to do is never say no. You just simply provide options. So this has always been Ted's mantra, so that if you're in the midst of shooting a scene that looks like it's going to run over or get too expensive, you don't say no. You simply say, well, you can do that, but then you won't be able to do X, Y, or Z. Frankly, it's pretty ludicrous way of saying no, but it sounds different than saying no.
One of the, I think, most successful films, maybe surprise successes, that Good Machine produced was Brothers McMullen. And I'm wondering at what point you knew that this was going to be a big hit, and if there was anything that you think you did to help make it a hit, or it just kind of struck a nerve and caught on.
I knew it was going to be a big hit the minute Ted told me it would be a big hit. Essentially, that was a film that, in its over 2-hour version, Eddie had shown to every distribution company and studio in North America, and they had passed on it. And Ted sat with Eddie in the editing room after he had shot the footage and really walked through what it would be and what it would take to get Eddie to make a film that would embody his vision and the fun of that vision and still be sellable in the marketplace. And so Ted really spent a good month and a half, I guess, on the night shift, which was the free shift in the editing room, sitting with Eddie and listening to him and kind of helping him walk through the final stages to get that film to marketplace. And it was really something of a thrill to be at the Sundance Film Festival that year with a film like The Brothers McMullen on the one hand, and on the other hand, a film that we had spent 4.5 years trying to finance, a film called Safe by a filmmaker named Todd Haynes.
I have to say, I think that's a great film.
Yeah, we're sublimely proud to have been even peripherally associated with that movie. And to have both of those films, on the one hand, a movie that really expressed the freshness and energy and excitement of independent cinema the way Eddie's film did, and on the other hand, a film that really expressed a young artist coming into consummate mastery of the craft of independent filmmaking, like Todd's film, that was pretty much of a high.
Well, I want to congratulate you both on your award from the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema, and thank you very much for talking with us about movies.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
James Shamus and Ted Hope are the founders of the production company Good Machine, which is based in New York. Their new movies are being spotlighted at the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema, which continues through May 10th.